Welcome to the Business Trend Center podcast, where we teach you all about trends and how to use them to grow your business. My name is Manny Turan.
And I'm Adam Hartung.
And we are Spark Partners. To learn about how to grow your business, go to our website at sparkpartners.com. Today we have a special guest. His name is Alex Eisman, and he's the CEO and co-founder. He's the CEO and founder of Genium. I'm going to bring it up right now, and we're going to have a discussion with him regarding AI and the way that teams are being put together these days. Let's bring in Alex.
Well, thank you so much for having me. My name is Alex Eisman. I'm the CEO of company Genium. I'm also a professional ice hockey referee working for the American Hockey League. On my free time, I write music. I compose music for films, and I also fly airplanes. I'm a private pilot, so happy to be on the show and talk about all things tech. And majority of people know me as a software engineer and expert in software development, and that's what Genium is all about, building high-quality software and building high-quality teams that support building software here in the United States. So I'm happy to be on the show and happy to talk deeper into certain things.
Very good. So one of the things that I really want to bring to the table and have both Adam and I understand the way that the software development process has changed over the past 10 years. So it's kind of a two-part conversation. I want to understand sort of how things have been moving to date. And then I also want to understand, more importantly, how things are going in the next 10 years.
All right. Great question. So over the past 10 years, the industry have changed tremendously. And we've seen anything from Web 1.0, Web 2.0. Now we're seeing a revolution of Web 3.0. And the development process have changed in a way that we used to build tools for ourselves and then use these tools to build other products. Right now, we are at the point where software engineer tech companies have a lot of tools out there in the form of libraries or ready-to-go elements that they can kind of use as a reference or use as a module for their product. So it became, in a matter, is much easier to develop software. Not much easier, but just easier than 10 years ago. But it also came with the risks. It came with the risks of security and vulnerabilities. As always, there are trade-offs, right? So you develop a software faster because you have more tools and their tools are more complex. But also you have all sorts of other factors that now play together. And we do see a trend in the software industry where people, more and more people go through boot camps and more people learn how to code and how to program. And they're really good engineers when it comes to building UI or certain light services. But when it comes to building a really hardcore low-end algorithms, you still need a mathematical degree, and there's less and less people that are coming out of colleges that have a really core architectural degree, and they can build really high-end products at the low level of things, from security, performance, etc. And we see the trend of getting more people that have learned to code themselves, and they're great at doing certain things, and they're great at doing front-end work, UI, websites, and etc. But also, if you're looking at high-performance video coders or video codecs for TikTok or Facebook or Instagram, that's where you need an architectural, mathematical degree, and we see a trend of having less and less of those people. And they're more in demand, so it is hard, it's scarce to find those people who know everything from the ground up. That's where we're going. We're going into the separation of people who know how to build a specific set of software, more of a kind of, I wouldn't say easier, but it's a really specific niche set of software. And when it comes to hardcore algorithms and security, we have less and less of those people. So we're kind of seeing that segregation. But it's going to be easier and easier to build software over time, easier and easier to build tools. We have other tools that now no-code platforms. Back when I started, we had virtually very few no-code platforms where you could just log in and click all around and build yourself a product. It's not going to be the best one. It's not going to be the fastest one, but you can do that. And that's an option because we're seeing that software development involved.
Today, a lot of businesses are built on platforms like AWS, Facebook. These platforms are prolific and everywhere. And since the 1st of December, we saw a fault in AWS that led to a pretty serious breakdown, and a lot of sites had no access and customers didn't have access. And back in November, we had the same thing happen with Facebook when it went down. I don't think Instagram went down, but Facebook went down for, I believe, almost a day. So when business people, we're talking to business people about the future, where they're going, what is the risk that is being built into these new business models that are built on these platforms?
Great question. So first, to address this, we used to have outages before AWS, and even if you had all the service on premises and things go wrong, your services will be down. And sometimes we would have services down for more than a day because certain companies didn't have enough manpower to overcome an issue or do certain things, which Amazon has, or Facebook. They have a lot of manpower to fix those things, and they fix them up pretty quickly. And just, I mean, it's just so noticeable because everybody are using those tools, and now everybody get a day off, and businesses, of course, lose money. It's a trade-off. With using those services, you're able to build your business much faster, reach a greater audience, and make more money. And those are just tools, and you factor in a downtime, and they have that analytics and statistics. What is their downtime on average a year, which is pretty minuscule compared to other services or the way it used to be. So I don't think it's a big issue. It is for certain companies. For us, when we build software and we are at a critical mass, we have an option to back up on other services. So like if we're using Amazon, there is a competitor, Google. So we can use certain part of the services on Amazon and have backup services on Google. So if something goes wrong on Amazon, we always have Google working. And there are certain redundancy levels that we can do for critical mission critical software. And sometimes it means we have to build certain things on premises and build a team that supports services on premises and mitigates those issues. And you have a certain checklist, as I like to use checklists in business as a pilot. There's a checklist how you build software and the right process. And if you need a certain level of redundancy, if you need a very minimum downtime, then you build three layers of redundancy, and then you have a minimum downtime and mitigate those risks. But it's going to happen more and more. More people rely on those platforms, and unfortunately, as a business owner, you just have to accept those risks and mitigate them by using different options. Just accept that they're going to happen and move on and mitigate them.
So, you know, Adam and I talk a lot about, we started off talking about four major trends. There's another one that kind of added to the list, and I want to kind of talk to you about what they are. And I want your perspective on how much the software world has been changed by, or how much it's changing these four things. That is, of course, the gig economy, mobility, asynchronous life, so communicating and working and living in an asynchronous way, artificial intelligence, and the new kid on the block is demographics, changing demography of the world. Give us an idea in your perspective how your vision of how software development has changed in those domains or been changed by those domains.
Right. Great question. So I'll just to address a few things. Right before the pandemic, actually a year right before that, my operational team came to me and gave me analytics on high level software engineers, really, really good software engineers requesting remote work. And we operate in the United States and Latin America and Eastern Europe. So we have offices in all around Latin America and Eastern Europe and US. And a lot of the people in Latin America would want to move to suburbs, and the people who can work remotely, they were asking that as part of the job offer package. And we started giving that as a trial, and then we've built cybersecurity around how to secure the perimeter for those remote locations. So people are moving remotely, that's number one. And we did this switch right before the pandemic hit, and then when the pandemic happened, everybody started working remotely, but we were ready to accept that challenge, and because of the great team that I have, and they foresee that change by looking at data, we've set up all the security perimeter to allow people to work remotely from the and transition to full remote team. We have offices, people go to offices, but it's a benefit right now. It's a, you know, you get a remote position with a benefit going to the office. Regarding the gig economy, I think it's to a certain degree it's a great business niche, and I think we'll start seeing more and more of this throughout years and finding more opportunities throughout different industries, and it's a trend. We see a lot of startups do that, and I'm very happy with this because we create more businesses, we create accessibility for other people to make money, and just share this. But I also think it's a trend, and a certain time frame, like in about 5 year period, I think it's going to wind down, and people will get their pillar gig economy providers like Uber and possibly some other stuff. But it's also going to move away from that to like Amazon and big corporations, because they are they're able to serve much better their customer because they have more data and more means to do that. Regarding mobility, as I said, it's number one priority right now. I don't even force people to work at the office unless they work on mission critical certain things, because we are Department of Defense certified software development company, and we work with specific projects that require people to be at the certain secure perimeter altogether, working at specific projects just from the security point of view. And just this alone, for certain teams, of course, they have to be at a certain place, but for the majority of the software engineers and anybody who can work remotely and do their work remotely, they would choose to do that. It's more productive, you save more time on travel, but it doesn't work for everybody, right? So we have about 40% people still like to go to the offices. They just prefer to be at a location, talk to other people more regularly than others, and I think it should be a choice. Regarding changing demographics, I think we'll have a pretty interesting problem in software development, at least, where we have a lot of millennials coming out and they don't have, as I said, fundamental degree of software engineering, but they have some sort of a boot camp or courses that they took and self-educated themselves. So the market was going to get oversaturated by those specialists, but not undersaturated by people who went to university, got their 4-year or master's in computer science, mathematics, and algorithms, and they're top of the top. But the big companies already are paying big bucks for them. TikTok offers $300,000 base pay for mobile engineers here in Silicon Valley, plus stock options, plus all the benefits and stuff. And those are the people who've got the core architectural degree in mathematics. That's who's getting those offers. So that's interesting. That's interesting to see. Remind me of the fourth thing that you were mentioning. I think I've touched base on
AI.
Great. This, we don't realize that AI has been around for quite some time. It's not a fully artificial intelligent copy of a human brain, but we've been dealing with AI for many years. Ever since Google Maps started, they use AI to give you the best optimal route. And we use AI for all the assistant, the Alexa, the Siri. That's been around for many years, and apps that we just don't see. It is a really powerful tool. I think it should be used carefully, but I think it is a powerful tool, and it's better to have that tool than not to have it. The amount of data humanity just generates is tremendous. One Boeing 777 generates 1 terabyte of data per flight, and they do those flights daily. So there's so much data, and human brain and algorithms cannot just crack on the analytics and how to monetize that data. That's where we need machine learning and AI, which is basically a machine learning algorithms that learn the data and they make sense of a huge data and then build certain models and behavioral models out of it to just make sense. A great example is I think in China, they're using IBM Watson, which predicts cancer treatments for cancer patients. And it's an AI, and China is moving towards this direction rapidly. They have a huge population. They don't have enough doctors. They don't have enough people to just analyze people's symptoms and everything. So they're using AI quite extensively, actually. They're putting in their data into those computers, and computers predict much better outcomes and much better treatment plans for cancer patients in China. That they're using it on a daily basis right now in major hospitals. And the really prediction on cancer, the best cancer treatment for a specific variation of it, the AI predicts it with the best outcome. It was 96.4%, and the doctor on average does it 93%. So AI does it a little better than a regular doctor. But AI can do it at scale, at a much bigger scale than doctors. So I'm all for AI. I think machine learning in general, analyzing a lot of data, and the world produces so much data that none of us can just keep up with it at the level that we would want. So we need help. We need help of computers and algorithms to make sense out of this data so we can make conscious decisions. But also, you know, be really careful about AI and what it can do, because it's still a machine. It's still a computer. It's been written by a human, and humans tend to make errors. And we should just have a checklist on how to mitigate those risks and not let do critical mission critical stuff, or at least have an override on mission critical stuff when it comes to AI.
Back in the days when people had their own computers, you know, we had the mainframes and many computers that went the way of the laptop and servers. There were always workarounds. So you, as you mentioned, you could have reliability issues, but people had a workaround, you know, and sometimes it was a paper-based workaround. Nowadays, things have changed because the technology itself is no longer in-house. The technology is out of house. It's residing in these other companies. And we have no idea how they built that technology. You know, they're completely lacking any transparency at all, for, you know, because that's how they defend their business long-term. But it seems to me like what that does is it changes the game for the people that are in business, because we have to use it. We have to use these, you know, these tools, Google, Facebook, AWS. We can't be in business today without it. But we don't have a fundamental understanding of how it works. So when you're looking at this and we're working with business people that have small to mid-sized businesses, what should they be looking for in the engineers or the software coders that they would hire to try to make their business effective? How would you characterize the job description, or how would you advise them to make sure they're hiring the right people to work with these platforms and be successful and lower their risks and all that good stuff?
Right. It's a great question. So for us, and I can show our example, we look for specific people with specific skill sets. So if we're talking about Facebook, we need people who work with Facebook extensively and they know how platform works to a certain extent. To your point, we don't know how the platform has, you know, operates underneath, but we have a certain knowledge of how it works and how to operate with this, and we have a statistical analysis when it can go down, what can be rejected, what can be banned, and more of that knowledge is in specific industry or specific tool is better. So when we build teams, we specifically look for a skill set that complements that team, that the skill set of the tools that the team is using, and that helps. That helps because the people know, people we hire, they know how those things work, and they know where to put the workarounds, as you said. Other thing is, you hire the people that are willing to learn, because the world is adapting really quick. And if something went down, let's say Facebook went down for a day, you've lost a business or you've lost, you know, certain deals. The first thing you do is you realize, how can you mitigate that? How can you communicate with your customers on other platforms? How can you utilize text messaging, right? When we have a product, Tusa.com, building a Genium, where you can communicate with your customers through text messages, right? So you try to migrate customers or have a second means of communication with them and have backups. As you said, we had backups. Nothing have changed. The humanity and tools haven't changed, and the process is the same way. To your point, we don't know how those platforms have built. When you have a PC at home, you don't know how those microcontrollers have been built. You haven't been on the factory. You don't know how it's all wired and when it's going to fail. Same thing. It's just came a level up. We don't know how those platforms have been built and how they operate. Sometimes things break, so we need to have a backup, other means of communicating with your clients. If something goes down, you send a text message to everybody saying, hey, you know, everything is down. Today we're communicating with you by text messages. And if you want to buy anything, just send the link or send us a request and we'll send the link back. And that's how you have separate means of communication and channels, email lists, text messages, et cetera. So that's my take. But yeah, hire the right people who know the platforms and who are...
So back again to that hiring. 50 years ago, if you were looking to hire somebody to work in the computer field, they either had a degree in electrical engineering or computer science. So we moved up to where the tools got easier to use. And by the time we get to, you know, about 25 years ago, 20, 25 years ago, we saw that a lot of times people could get a degree from the College of Business. So now they're in the business school. They're not in the engineering school or liberal arts mathematics department, and they're getting some business training, and they're getting a lot of training around how to use Microsoft products. And so we would say, all right, we see Microsoft certification on John's resume or Betty's resume, and that helped people know how to, you know, what the skill set people have when they're hiring them. They go to work, they continue to go to Microsoft training programs. These were offered either through Microsoft or through junior colleges or through four-year universities. Now it's changed. You know, now I don't know of any university that's, you know, offering a program in social media or teaching people, you know, at a college how to be an expert at operating with Google or operating with any of these tools, to be honest. So how would a small business, a medium-sized business, find the skills? How would they even put it into the job description? How would they go about the recruiting, and how would they know if a person actually has the skills?
Right. It's a great question. So first of all, job description is really important, and you lay down the basic fundamental things that are relevant to a specific industry. If we're talking about software, I need an engineering degree, and I need certain architectural knowledges, and I need to see a path of growth, promotions, and willingness to educate themselves, and how they are they good learners. And you do that through interviews, right? So, and then you do reference checks, right? So you talk to their managers and see how they've been working at specific projects for us. For social media, it's a great question. I mean, it's a completely different beast. You're totally right. Not a lot of universities offer those programs. However, certain ones do offer that. But to be honest, by the time the person gets a degree, the platforms are so different at that time. So they change every 3 to 4 months. Algorithm changes every 3 months on those platforms. And you have to be in the industry. So what I would suggest is, aside of putting effective communication for us and certain specific skill set that you want from that person, be coachable and check that throughout the interviews. You also look at the track record, see where he worked and or she worked at and what she've done throughout the recent years, and you seek people with experience. You offer good benefits and market economy. They want to work on more exciting projects, and sometimes you train them too. So if you know somebody who is willing to train them on social media, you can hire a consultant just to train a person, a junior person or a mid-level person, and then they take over and do that. It does take 2 years to take a junior person and train them into a more of a mid-level senior person. Like that's what I've seen, a year to 2 years at least. So it's better to just hire somebody off the market who, off of a competitor, just headhunt if it's a hard specific niche to hire, or get a consultant that did a successful work, and get a junior guy, get a consultant, I'll let them work together for some time, and over a period of year or year and a half, you get a person that knows how to do things, but also grow the team because you have to have redundancy. So that's when it comes to social media. Pretty tough topic.
Recently, we all saw in the news that there was this horrible tornado that went through the middle of the United States, and one of the things that got pointed out was the number of businesses that were destroyed. So now let's think about this for a minute. Here's this very large candle company located in Kentucky, and I don't remember, it was like 100,000 square foot building they had that was destroyed. But that's a substantial business, and they're selling candles to the JCPenney's to the Walmarts of the world, to the retail brick and mortar trade. They also have, they're selling through Amazon and the e-commerce, and they have their own direct e-commerce business, right, where they're selling candles direct. But they're located in Kentucky. Now, it looks to me like in the world that we're headed towards, these sorts of organizations that are located outside of the San Francisco, the Carolinas, they're not in the major cities, they're going to increasingly have to depend on gig workers to do the kind of work you're talking about. Because I don't think they're going to be able to find them, in the East St. Louis, Missouri's, the Wichita, Kansas, or even smaller towns like Enid, Oklahoma. So I think we have to go to the gig economy to find these people. But what's your sense about that?
Well, I think the bigger the gig economy grows, the more regulated it gets. So we see a great example here in San Francisco that Uber had to qualify their drivers as full-time employees. So I think it's really a matter of finding people. Doesn't matter who they are, where they are. It's really where you can find the people, and then how they qualify, and the gig economy obviously helps out, but it helps out for a year or two until the state cracks down on it and then they start just treating them as full-time employees. I think business has to adapt, really. In my world, in software, obviously I'm a little in a better position because I don't have to have a brick and mortar relied on people on the ground. But still, like with COVID, we had people that have gone offline, and I had to do a private investigation on where they are. A guy in Peru just disappeared for a couple of weeks, nothing. Like he had corporate laptop and certain information. We had to hire certain people to go investigate where the person is, and he ended up in a hospital with COVID, we were able to help him out and transfer him over to his home country. He was traveling at that time. But to your point, really, I'm not 100% sure how those companies can use gig economy effectively. I know it's just a temporarily measure that is going to convert into full time a certain thing anyway, and that's where it's all going more or less. But as I said, businesses constantly have to look for alternatives.
In your role as you're out there recruiting, do you think people that live in a San Francisco, that live in a tech central area like Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and they're trying to stay on top of all these trends in social media and these new platforms, are they willing to take a full-time job working for a company that's located in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? They're not likely to move there. Are they willing to take a full-time job and work remotely? Is it remote work that would be the way that they would get supported? And should our listeners be actively recruiting for these skills in these hot markets and expecting to pay top dollar for these people, but also expecting them to work remotely?
It's a good question. So Google adjusts their salary when a person moves out of state, and I think the same happens with other companies as well. Remote is definitely a way to go if it's the right fit for the company and for their operations. It's not the ideal scenario for majority of the companies, so there has to be an option. But to your point, yes, if I were a business somewhere in the middle of United States where I don't have a hard market and I need to hire top talents, I would need to pay top dollars or open a lot of companies do that, open a small office in Silicon Valley and hunt, and just fight for those talents. Otherwise, what we've done, we just go globally. We go globally and get the best talents all around the world where we can find them. And just open up the market. Once you go remotely, you can hire anywhere and get the best out of all the billions we have on planet Earth, rather than limiting yourself.
So do you think it's smart for these companies in the United States, small to mid-sized companies, to look for technology and software talent in third world countries, in India, Philippines, Thailand, Taiwan, and other places like Eastern Europe, where I think you're from, should they be recruiting in those locations, even though they're located in one of these second or third tier cities in the United States?
When it comes to building a remote team, it doesn't really matter where a company is located. We have a lot of companies that are based on different states that are not tech hubs, and things work well. And that's exactly to your point. They're able to pay a little higher dollars to get best talents. I wouldn't go to India or China or Philippines specific countries. Like, our focus on really high-end software development, we go to Latin America for Argentina, Uruguay, and we have Brazil. So where it's not per se third world country, we have really well-educated people there and they have really good English. They're not cheap. So they're not cheap by all means. They are a little cheaper than the United States market, but they're not cheap compared to all the other ones. So you have to carefully pick where you want to hire. For remote teams, it is essential to have effective communication. And if you have Latin America, it's essentially similar time zone or same time zone with New York half of the year, and they work the same business hours. So it's essential to have them working the same business hours and communicating with you constantly. Which helps because a lot of the Latin America people, they're extroverts. They like to talk, and that's just Spanish culture. And that also helps. That helps because they convey their messages better and they communicate better and more open to it. I would definitely do that. I would definitely go outsourcing, but I would be very careful about the location I pick. Eastern Europe also has good locations like Ukraine, Belarus. We also has certain risks. Russia as well. You know, some companies work with Russia. We don't, but some companies do work with Russia as well. I wouldn't go to India, China, Philippines, unless you're 100% certain how to work with that mentality. Like for me, I was not able to figure out the right mentality or the right quality model inside of my company, how to integrate in those markets. I think the cultural difference for what we build and the effective communication and the language barrier is pretty big, or I wasn't able to build a success model around using those markets. So you have to be very careful about using those markets and when. And certain markets are good for one task, and certain markets are good for another task. So you just have to know where to go and seek talents for a specific skill set.
Well, Manny, I know you've had a couple of technical glitches while we were on the call here today. So I've sort of hogged the question time. Do you have anything more?
Yeah, I'm back. I don't know. I had to restart my browser like three times having some major computer issues.
Well, I think you should have a technology glitch when we're interviewing a technology expert. That's the way it happens, Manny.
You know, that's how it is. You have something going on with your car, you take it to the mechanic, and they don't hear anything, right? Well, this has been very informative for sure. And so I want to get your last thought here, Alex, on how you see what can a small business owner do if they are interested in developing a piece of software. What's the first step they should take in this new landscape of either bringing on a team like yours or using these no code sort of situations? What's your recommendation for a small business here as they launch an idea to the market?
Great question. So my first question is to sit down and analyze the impact of the tool you'll be building. Because if the second you start building a tool and let's say work with us or work with any other software development company, you're kind of turning into a software company. So now you have a software product, you need to have a software team to maintain that product, and the returns have to be significant. So the impact of the tool has to be significant in order to invest into building a custom tool. So the first thing I would do is to strip down everything off of this idea and find the minimum viable product, which is the minimum functionality that you can deliver to your customers and start using it as soon as possible so you can get that feedback. And then focus on how to get this minimum functionality with absolute minimum efforts, meaning that you don't think, you know, big right off the box, I need to have all the apps on Android and iOS and web and everywhere and has to work and have all the bells and whistles before I launch it. Just launch small, start getting that feedback, and then start using into other platforms. No code is good for specific things. If you're not heavily on user interface and usage, if you don't have a lot of users basically using the platform, no code could be a good option. If your goal is to provide really good user experience, fast and beautiful, then you have to build custom. It really depends on the goal, but start small, start really small, roll it out as soon as possible to the market, because market will tell you what needs to be done. Don't make assumptions. A lot of businesses build a lot of huge decks. We need this, we need that. Just build a minimum viable product first, get it to the market, start getting that feedback early. And if you think about working with us or any other software company, you have to know that you are turning into a software company, because software, custom software needs to be maintained and from security point of view, constantly. So you have to have a software team and you have to maintain them on payroll to build that platform. And now you're competing for the software talents among others, you know, Google, TikTok, Facebook, and they're paid big dollars. So you're getting into that game. And oftentimes companies use us to maintain that software as well, and they have teams that just maintain them long term, which is a little bit more cost effective. But still they're turning themselves into a software company. So think how you can get to that point as quick as possible, get it to the market, and start getting that feedback from users.
Don't know. Awesome. Very good. Adam, any final questions here?
No, I think it's been a lot of fun talking about this. Our client base definitely needs to understand that you are a tech company today. It's impossible to think you're going to be successful in 2025, 2030 without having a big part of your business tied up in technology. You know, it's the reason that Amazon is Amazon, Tesla is Tesla, is that, you know, they're not locked into the old business model. They're moving forward. So paying attention to software development, where it's headed, and how we can bring in the big trends is going to be crucial for everyone. let Alex have some time to share his thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much, guys. It was so fun. And thank you so much, guys. And right to the point about exactly it is. Every company should be that company should think this way.
All right. Well, we appreciate your time, Alex. And we'll be looking out for these changes in the software industry. And